Hey guys, welcome to Adventures in Healing with Graham and Alex. This week we're going to be talking with Bob Podolsky, who's the originator of the Octalog, which is a very cool way to implement creative solutions in groups, which could replace government. Follow Bob at titanians.org. If you like the content, if you're liking our show, then please help us continue. Go to our website, adventuresinhealing.com. And throw us a few bucks on the Patreon site. That'd be much appreciated. So thanks for listening, and hope you enjoy.
You know, 2 years ago, in the 2016 in Acapulco, Michael came to my talks, and he liked them. And so I gave a workshop, and he came to that, and he liked it. And he got a group going here. And when I heard about that, and I thought, I'd been living several years in Arizona, and there wasn't that much happening there, even though I was giving talks there all the time. So I hoofed it down here. And I'm really glad to be here. This is a very, really cool community. I'm really liking folks like you.
Here. And that's really interesting, because my decision to go to Anarchapulco was actually after I heard a podcast with you on Jeff Berwick talking about Octalogs, and like I immediately was, whoa, that sounds really, really cool. The like a group of eight people getting together, it's a small enough group to reach consensus and really know the people in the group. That really connected with me, and then I made the decision to go to Acapulco, and
fantastic.
Now I'm here in Acapulco.
there you go. That's the way we like to see it happen.
Yeah.
Most people need multiple exposures to the concepts before they get it. And here and there, like yourself, there's a few people around who got it right away. The first person ever to really catch on to the value of the Octalog instantly was a friend of mine who goes by the name Morpheus. You may have heard he recently got arrested.
Yeah, I saw your post about that.
Yeah, well, I was giving a talk at a meeting of the Libertarian Party of Palm Beach County. This was back when I thought libertarians might actually be like anarchists. I was naive about what they're about. They are statists, and they mainly are interested in getting their people elected. And I didn't realize that at the time, but I gave the talk and talked a little bit about octalogs and ethics. And Morpheus was there, and boy, he got it right away. That was in 2005, and we've been good friends ever since. I'm really concerned about him getting arrested on this bogus crap that they are going after bitcoins, you know. They're gonna, I predicted, there's an article on titanians.org that I wrote a couple of years ago when I first got excited about Bitcoin, and I predicted that government would try to stomp on it, at some point they'd recognize that it threatened the fiat currency religion, or whatever you want to call it, and they would try to shut it down. And they are now more and more actively doing that, and arresting people who buy and sell bitcoins is one of the ways they're doing that. And what they do is they go on to local bitcoins and find out who are the most prominent dealers in bitcoins, and they sting them. You know, they get someone who's selling contraband, like dope, to become a customer and then to testify against them. Oh, well, he's my money launderer. You know, that's what they're doing. They're going after people that way. Eventually, they will shut down local bitcoins in the United States, and probably a lot of foreign countries will follow suit because they want to do business in the U.S., and they'll be told, well, if you want to do business in the U.S., you've got to shut down local bitcoins. So I'm expecting a lot of negative flack coming our way from the whole cryptocurrency activity, which has the potential to put the bankers out of business.
Yeah.
And I hope it does. But in the meantime, we will be more and more under attack in that way. Where are you going to find someone from whom to buy Bitcoins? Well, you go online. Well, what are your choices online? Well, there are these regulated groups that act like banks and use the know your customer rules for banks to sell Bitcoins, which is absurd. And there's local Bitcoins, where you find someone locally and, you know, meet them face to face and buy Bitcoins from them. Well, that is a point of attack. That's a place where governments will go after people. Mm-hmm. And I told Morpheus when he first started buying and selling Bitcoins, I said, you better be careful. You better watch out for this. And he said, oh yeah, I'm careful. Right, now he's in prison. So I'm trying to raise money to get him free, to get him a good lawyer. You know, there are people like Mark Stevens who talk about the illegitimacy of the law. And one way of dealing with it is you go into court and you challenge jurisdiction right up front before you even take the oath or make a plea. Unfortunately, you're still at the mercy of the judge when you do that. Because the judge can say, that's a frivolous argument.
Challenge the jurisdiction means saying you don't have any legitimacy to make a ruling over me?
Right.
Okay.
Right. The most concise way of putting it is to challenge jurisdiction by asking the question, do you have any factual evidence whatsoever that your law that you're attempting to enforce applies to me? And in fact, there is no such thing as factual evidence to that, because all of the evidence is things people wrote down, and that has long since been recognized as opinion written on paper, or simply as the scribblings of a bureaucrat legislator.
There's no contract that this person signed that said, give you right to rule over
me. No consent.
Or to make laws, you know, about my non-aggressive behavior.
Exactly. And in fact, that also, applies to aggressive behaviors. There is no factual evidence. By factual, I mean, you know, like, factual is like science. If something's factual, you can demonstrate it. Okay. Show me the demonstration that you have authority over me. I've got a piece of paper that says so. Well, that's not factual evidence. That's just hearsay or opinion. Mm. And these guys keep maintaining that if they write an opinion down, that makes it law. That means you have to obey. What? You write something down and I have to obey? How about I write something down and you have to obey? What gives you more right to do that than me? Oh, well, we got elected. So what? Yeah. I have neighbors and friends. I could get them here as my supporters. We're a majority. What if I had the majority? Would that give me the right to rule you? No, it doesn't. You know, it's really basic stuff, but the public has been so dumbed down about so many things that it's very easy for people to be fooled these days because they don't have decent education. I've been more and more and more appalled at what's going on in the public education system, which includes the universities. They're all run by cartels.
And it really showed in the last years.
Oh, yeah.
With the censorship of speech and the political correctness.
Exactly. That's a good example. One of many. There are many examples. If you understand what a cartel is a shared monopoly. And a cartel has only two purposes. One is to maximize the members' profits, and the other is to maintain the monopoly status of the group. That's all they care about. They don't have any morality. They don't have any ethics. All they care about is those two things. Well, that's why cartels always contract with governments to support their laws or rules. So if I have enough people behind me and enough money behind me, I can hire some legislators to enforce my rules.
Which in itself is a cartel, the government.
Yes, it's a little different kind of cartel, but okay. It is a cartel. Every government is a cartel. And there are cartels within cartels, and cartels comprised of cartels. The European Union is a cartel. United States is a cartel. And when I think of cartels, usually I'm thinking of things like universities are run by cartels. And if you are unpopular with the cartel, you don't get to teach in the university. And this is a big part of what I do with soul bonding. You know, psychology, psychiatry, all of these clinical disciplines are controlled by cartels that make up rules which they contract with governments to enforce. Governments love it because they these bureaucrats get to hire more people. And have either of you ever worked for government?
Worked for government?
Have you?
No.
No. Well, when you work for government, you find out pretty quick the status in that society is based on how many people report to you. The more people report to you, the higher your status and the higher rank you obtain, either in civil service or through elections, and the more money you make. So people want to expand their realms or domains when they work in government.
Their fiefdom.
Yeah, so they're perfectly happy. Oh, you want some laws made for your benefit? Great, you know. Grease my wheels, pay for my publicity and whatnot to, around my election, and we'll do whatever you want. And they do. That's how the government works.
And it's called lobbyism, and everybody knows it's going on.
Yes. Yes, it is publicly recognized bribery that has been legitimized, just like all the other terrible things that have been legitimized by scribbles on pieces of paper. It's appalling, infuriating on my part. I get really pissed off at times about the whole thing. I've had to work really hard not to be angry all the time, because we're so surrounded by this corruption stuff. So it's really bad. And most people, even ones who realize it's bad, most people don't realize how bad it is. It's incredibly bad. Think, for example, about 9/11. I figured out pretty early that 9/11 was an inside job because I applied some physics formulas to, okay, how much energy is there in that plane and how much energy will it take to bring the building down? And I did some calculations, and clearly the available energy to bring down the building was only about 1% of what it would require as a minimum. And I was very conservative in my calculations. But I had engineering manuals that I could use to say, okay, what's the temperature of burning kerosene? Oh, well, okay, that depends on how much oxygen it's getting, but what about at normal atmospheric pressures, you know, or in normal atmosphere, how hot does that stuff burn? Well, let's see, 750 degrees Fahrenheit maximum. That's why all the black smoke instead of gray or white smoke. Oh, well, how much heat does it take to soften steel? Well, I have a manual on steel girders and shit, you know. My father was really into learning engineering at one time, and I inherited the manuals that he had, and one of them has, he had put in tabs down the side of the pages for different cross sections of girders and whatnot. And I could go in there and I can look up, you know, the actual temperature at which these things soften, lose their strength, melt, and so on. And it was vastly more than 750 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, you can hold a 750 degree Fahrenheit flame under a steel girder forever and you'll never soften it. Especially if that girder is connected to lots and lots of other girders and the heat spreads out along the girders. Which it will. They're pretty good conductors. Impossible that that would bring down the building. So I knew early on that we're being lied to. And once you realize that the planes and the fires could not have brought the buildings down, you start looking deeper, and it's just lie after lie after lie after lie. And people buy it. Mm-hmm. People are not educated. They don't have a manual to look up the temperature of burning kerosene, you know, they don't know that such information even exists. And if they thought it would exist, they didn't know where to look for it. So there's a lot of education in the ignorance of the public, so to speak.
Part of that seems to be indoctrination as well. Like it's not even just purely the lack of information people are getting, but it's also how the education system is shaping how they see the world and the filters that they see the world through.
Right, exactly. And what it comes down to is they don't want to see. They've been indoctrinated not to. So.
And it's also a very concerning realization to realize that the very state that's supposed to take care of you and it's portrayed as the savior of humanity the whole time is actually the perpetrator of the most evil.
True. Quite true.
Okay, so you mentioned ethics earlier, and I kind of want to get into that because I thought it was really interesting when I heard you first speak about that at the Narcapulco. Mm-hmm. Your four values of ethics and then the four byproducts of those values. And over the last months, I came back to think about that. And so the values are truth, awareness, love, and creativity.
Yes.
And the byproducts of that are peace, prosperity, happiness, and...
Freedom.
Freedom.
Yes.
And to me, that was very interesting to have a philosophy that values happiness not as a ultimate goal, but simply as a byproduct of other values.
That's partly accurate, mostly accurate. But the one piece that is missing from that is the fact that when you make happiness the highest priority, if you substituted happiness, say, for truth, you wind up unhappy. People who set happiness as their highest priority are miserable. And there are good reasons for it. One can go into that. I mean, I prefer not to take the time to go into those details for this conversation, but it's pretty straightforward to show that if the thing you want is happiness, the fact that you're wanting it, in effect, says you don't have it. And you wind up remaining that way by holding that, I want this, I want this. Well, why don't you have it? I want it. Putting myself in the posture of wanting, I mean, sometimes the word wanting literally means lacking. Mm-hmm. He's wanting. I'm wanting freedom. Too bad, you can't have it. You're going to be less free because you're wanting. Whereas, seeking truth, awareness, love, and creativity works. If you seek those and you make those your highest priorities, you wind up with more of them. That's a valid ethic, providing the belief system is properly framed, which is simply that an act is good if it increases one of those four, which incidentally, it can only increase all of them or none of them. If it increases any of them, they all increase. But for the purposes of definition, if an act increases one of them without limiting or diminishing any of those for anyone, it's an ethical act. And that is consistent and it works. If you live by that, you get more and more of what you really want. And incidentally, you get happiness and freedom and prosperity and so forth and other benefits. I can't really account for why that is so, but that's what, over many years, I've observed to be the case. And in fact, it was first pointed out to me by John David Garcia, who was my mentor from 1984 until his death in 2001. And during that time, he invented the octet. And then I made changes to the octet, and it became the octalog. So, for those who are unfamiliar, let me quickly define what an octalog is. Mm-hmm. It's a group of 7 to 9 people. It doesn't start out at 7 to 9 people. It starts out with one person with an important idea. And he then brings other people into the group. But the group isn't going to exceed 9 people, except there are some very, very detailed ways of stretching that boundary a little bit. But basically, you're looking at 7 to 9 people who commit to an ethical purpose, a shared purpose. And they decide they're going to make their decisions unanimously. It takes a little learning. But with only typically 8 people in the group, you don't need to pass a talking stick around. You can just have a conversation like we're having a conversation. So it's a small enough group that the communication works and the number of relationships within the group is manageable. Okay, here am I with, say, 7 other people. Well, I can handle 7 close relationships. I would not be able to handle 70 close relationships. So I want to limit the size of the group, and that makes it possible to have really good decisions. Anyone in the group can veto a decision that they think would be unethical. Oh, well, you're not going along with that. We're going to discuss it. And you discuss it until you reach unanimity. And there are all kinds of practice you can do to learn how to do that if it's difficult. The other thing is the people in the group agree to give each other feedback. And not only to offer feedback, but to listen to the feedback given to them. That's the hard part of the whole thing. That is the hardest part. And it is based on that experience that we've decided to add the soul bonding component to the definition of the octalog. That you have to have, if not soul bonding per se, you have to have some mechanism whereby people can hear the feedback without their defenses getting in the way. And the defenses are always characterological. They go back to what did you experience as a child when you were little, before the age of 5. Mostly before the age of 5. There are a few exceptions.
Do you want to talk a little bit about soul bonding then?
We can do that. I don't want to go into a lot of detail because, as you know, there's a lot of detail in soul bonding. But soul bonding is a communication protocol, if you will. It is a set of techniques that go together whereby people can identify the elements of their own character structure and grow out of them, in effect. I can learn to lower my defenses in order to hear things and to see things that I was unable to hear and see while I still had those defenses in place, because we're talking about the filters that you mentioned. The filtering of information goes through this stuff that we get conditioned with early on, and we become incapable under ordinary circumstances of seeing and hearing what's right in front of us. This may seem strange to a lot of people, but it's reality that we can, in fact, filter out information that's right in front of us. Hypnotically, we can do this experimentally. I could hypnotize one of you and say that the other one is not in the room, and you're not going to see him or hear him. And then he can actually go like this in front of you, and you will not respond. And he can shout in your ear, and you'll go, what's going on here? You won't recognize that the other person's in the room. It's a hypnotically induced selective blindness or selective deafness. Well, we have those things operating all the time through our character structure, the set of defenses that we use to protect ourselves when we're little. And as infants and toddlers, we need those defenses because our parents aren't that skilled at managing us, if you will, when we're little, and the parents are unskilled at that, they're likely to do things to us to get us to control us that are permanently damaging. Mm-hmm. But they don't know that. They do it unwittingly, but I've never met someone who did not have a character structure, ever, because our culture is such as it is. So the soul bonding is drawn from six different psychotherapeutic disciplines that were developed for clinical work. And what I've done is I've divorced those from the clinical practice and incorporated it into an educational practice. Of course, the real education happens at the subconscious level, which is kind of tricky. Okay, we're going to do education! But you may or may not know at any given moment that your subconscious is being educated. Okay, it works. And it sets us free. It sets us free from the mental traps that we get set up in when we're very little. And there are five kinds of early mental traps that people get into, archetypal character structures. But we learn to recognize those. Oh, wow, cool. Now we can do something about it. So what I've done is I've introduced some of that know-how into the Octalog. And I'm basically telling people, if you want to form an Octalog, you've got five ways that people in your group can sabotage what you're doing. It would be a good idea to have someone available who can sort things out for you when you get run into conflicts, because the conflicts are almost always of characterological origin. And so if you have someone there who knows the soul bonding, not even in its entirety, but just parts of it, who can say, oh, I know what's going on here. We're having this conflict because we have a characterological conflict. We've got someone in the room with a character structure that's undermining our process. Let's help them. Let's get them over that. We can do this. So the whole soul bonding technology is now has become part of the Octalog lore.
Interesting. And then the Octalog is used to achieve purposes and help people organize without the hierarchy?
Yes. It's non-hierarchic. Think about it. If I'm in a group where I can veto any decision, and anyone else in the group can veto any decision, we're not in a hierarchy.
Yeah.
In a hierarchy, there's always a boss who calls the shots. So it's non-hierarchic, in some ways very egalitarian, though not in the socialist or communist way, quite the contrary. And of course, if you have a project that takes more than 8 people, you need a bigger group. Well, guess what? You can form ethical contracts between octalogs to form a bigger group, which we call a holomat. That's short for holotropic matrix. And basically, it is a group where all of the useful information, ideally, is available everywhere in the organization. That's why it's holotropic. A holograph contains information uniformly, more or less. In other words, do either of you have any familiarity with how an actual holograph is formed? Is that part of your experience or not?
I know it's the information about the whole hologram is contained within each cell of the hologram.
Right, right. To put it in real practical terms, if I want to make a holographic image, I take a beam of photons and I split it. And I use half of that beam to illuminate the thing I'm taking a holographic picture of. And I bounce the other half off of another mirror and get a different image from that one. And then these two are put together on, typically on a, what was a photographic plate. Nowadays there are sensors they can use, like photographic sensors in a camera instead of a photographic plate. But think about it as a piece of film. And you look at the image, you hold up the piece of film, and it's just a blur. You don't see an image until you shine a laser through it. And now you get an image from the laser interacting with this thing, and it's a three-dimensional image. You move your head like this, and you see different sides of the object. Mm-hmm. Here's a microphone. I can see it from over here. I can see it from over here. I can get a three-dimensional image of the object in that way. But if I take that piece of plastic that's the plate and I cut it in half and do the same projection with it, I get the same image, even though I've taken half of that thing away. It's not quite as clear an image. And if I do it in half again, so I'm looking at a quarter of the original piece, same thing. I lose some of the integrity of the image, but the image remains there, the whole image. It's not like I cut the image in half. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. So when I say something is holotropic, I mean it is tending toward that kind of distribution of information. I believe that the universe is a holographic phenomenon, and that the brain is a quantum mechanical machine that can interact with that holographic universe. And this is how we get new information that's valuable. And we have a process in the Octalogue called amplification, where we literally amplify creativity by having a group meditation that taps into the quantum mechanical universe. Now, I can't prove that that mechanism that I just described is really what's happening, but it might as well be, because it works.
Something's happening,
and it works as if we were able, as a group, to tap into a vast resource of information and download new information. There is the risk, we don't know when we do that, if the information we are downloading is true or false, but science tells us how to test for that. And so we can then test the information. Mm-hmm. And say, it's true or it's not true.
But that process is proven to be very helpful.
Oh, yeah. Very helpful. Yeah, what
happened? Can you describe it a little bit?
Well, eight people typically sit elbow to elbow in a circle. And depending on the design of the chairs, we may be holding hands or we may have our arms over each other's shoulders. And we visualize certain things. We visualize a flow of energy around the circle. We visualize an energy field in the shape of a torus with ourselves inside.
Nice.
The donut. And so if we're sitting inside a torus, and the torus is big enough, there will be a column of energy in front of us, which we picture as rising out of the ground and spreading out in the quantum universe, and then coming back around and circulating. We picture that. Meanwhile, we're breathing in time with each other, and we have some rules that we follow in our communication. And the rules are simple. When you get a new idea that you haven't had before, the first time it occurs to you, you mentally push it away. No, I'm not going to say that. But if the same idea comes back a second time, we oblige ourselves to share it with the group, no matter how strange, weird, bizarre, or obscene the idea happens to be. And it turns out that some of the strangest ideas have the most information in them when you later examine them. And of course, we record the session, because frequently we go into such an altered state that when we come out of it, we don't remember what was said, even if we said it. But we record it. Later, when we're not in that state, we play it back and examine each submission. And amazing things come out of that. hugely amazing things. It's a very synergistic process. And having devised the process, there are all kinds of things out there that sort of give credence to, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, you look at the history of meditation, you look at people like Campbell who, you know, are really into spiritual stuff and meditation and so on. My big contribution to that particular piece of technology was figuring out a shortcut to get the group synchronized, because there is a synchronization of brains going on in that process. And it used to take John David 3 days to get people synchronized. I do it in about 3 hours. So that was pretty much, it was when I did that that the octet became the octalogue. It's something a little bit different than the original octet. We've streamlined the process. Basically hypnotic means. So that's the overview of the octalogue and the soul body. And my mission in life is to see these technologies go worldwide and become widely used in place of hierarchies. If we can defeat the hierarchy mentality, we have a chance to turn the world around into something really beautiful. But I don't know, we could be too late. I can't say for sure. I'm pretty good at predicting things. In 1957, I predicted that the United States and the Soviet Union were going to become more and more alike until they became indistinguishable. And that's exactly what happened. Exactly what happened. The U.S. became more socialistic, the Soviets became more, whatever, capitalistic, I suppose. And the two have basically done this. And if you look at it as a perturbation theory kind of thing, you'll see this dying down of the perturbations, so that you wind up with more and more stable, bad circumstance. I tend to look at things in kind of engineering and physics terms. Perturbation theory is part of what made quantum mechanics.
So. Is that to do with things being disruptive or disruptive?
Well, it's really about if you have a physical system and you make some little change in it, how does that change propagate through the system? And there are physical phenomena which can best be described by mathematics of how something adjusts to a perturbation or a little adjustment. And it has many applications. You take a crystal lattice, for example, and you shoot a neutron through it. And the neutron may or may not interact with some of the atoms in that crystal. It may just go right through it without interacting with any of them. But as soon as it interacts with any of them, you have a perturbation in the crystal structure. I once spent a whole summer calculating what happens if you have a crystal and there are vacancies in it because some particle came along and knocked an atom out of the crystal. Now you've got a hole. Well, not infrequently, another atom will drop into that hole, but it'll leave a hole. So it's as if the hole moves through the crystal. They call it crystal lattice vacancy diffusion. And in that way, crystals can actually be annealed. They come to they approach a condition of stability or equilibrium. Well, society is a lot like that in some ways. We have all our rigid ideas about things, and whoop, oh my goodness, somebody invents an internet. That's a big perturbation. What kind of effects are going to come out of that? Well, some big, drastic, immediate effects, and then some long-range effects that aren't even suspected at the beginning, and so on. So perturbation theory has its place. And when I started writing articles, I thought of myself as a systems analyst, basically taking complex social systems and analyzing them. And they're not that hard to analyze. The conclusion I drew long ago, which you probably have already encountered in reading Flourish, is the idea or notion that, how to put this? Sorry, I'm kind of losing track of where I was trying to keep too many things in my head at one time.
You're talking about society.
Yeah.
And systems analysis.
Conclusion we have institutions of various kinds, societal institutions. And we've come to a place where most societal institutions make unethical decisions consistently. It's not like once in a while they make a mistake. It's like once in a while they get something right instead of once in a while they make a mistake. And the thing that has to change, I mean, I see this as humanity's big problem. I refer to it as such. That our institutions make unethical decisions, and as long as that's true, we're going to keep going downhill in terms of things are going to get worse and worse. At some point, we have to institutionally make ethical decisions, and it's much easier to do that in a whole amount of octologues than any kind of hierarchy. In hierarchy, hierarchies lend themselves to bureaucratization, which is the systematic elimination, destruction, or avoidance of corrective feedback. That is the nature of bureaucracy. And in hierarchies, that's what almost always takes over, with few exceptions. I could actually name some exceptions. It doesn't have to be that way in a hierarchy, but it usually is. And you wind up with a society in which information flows downward and almost nothing flows upward. And so the head of the organization doesn't know what the hands and feet are doing, let alone being able to make rational decisions about it. So when people ask me what I do, I've come to the awareness that really all I do is I observe, analyze, and report. My reports may be verbal, like what I'm doing right now, or in writing. And I've written lots of articles, and my soul bonding book will be my 8th book.
That's almost done.
It's almost done, yeah. I've finished writing the text.
Okay.
I'm waiting for some reviewers to make comments on it. We have yet to make decisions about the artwork on the cover and the comments on the back cover and so on. But the bulk of it's done. And for those of you in that group, you're welcome to read it. I can send you a PDF of the latest draft.
That'd be great.
Yeah, if I don't know if I have your email address, so make sure I have it before we're done.
Okay.
So that's...
Do you know the name of it? Is it going to be called Soul Bonding, or...?
As of now, the title is still Soul Bonding, A New Approach. The subtitle is A New Approach to Personal Growth and Human Syzygy.
Interesting.
You know the term syzygy?
I'm not familiar with it.
It has two meanings. One is astronomical, where a number of things you can see in the sky line up, like a star will line up with a planet, with the sun, and all that kind of thing. Things line up. But in biology, there's another meaning. If you have two single-celled animals, sometimes they will come together and stick together. And then the interface between them dissolves and they exchange half of the chromosomes of each. And then they reform the boundary between them and separate. Hmm. So each one becomes genetically half the other. And they both benefit from this.
And they double in information, I guess, because they retain what they had before.
They retain what they had, although there is a dilution of the original information in terms of the makeup of the whole organism. But when they reproduce, they reproduce in kind. So there is an improvement in the general gene pool as a result of it. Human syzygy is a little different, but it's a nice metaphor where two people become so close that they share who they really are, as opposed to who they'd like to be, who they put themselves out publicly as being, and so on. It's sort of the ultimate intimacy. I was married for 38 years to a woman with whom I had that kind of relationship, and it's like nothing else. When two people have that kind of closeness, it's just a wonderful, amazing experience for those two people. It means learning how to lower one's defenses way beyond what most people are willing to do. But Leah and I had that relationship, and it didn't start out like that. But we started out with some basic agreements. The most important one was, we will always be honest and forthcoming about what we think and feel, particularly in relation to one another. So for the first few years we were together, we were banging our heads together, we were screaming and shouting at each other, we were really pissed off a lot of the time because each of us was used to being in control, total control of our lives, and we were worried about how much control over my life am I going to give this other person. And then we found Harville Hendrix and began applying some of his communication tools, and all the fighting went away. And we began giving workshops on relationships, because she was a clinical social worker, and we had a practice together, and we ran groups together, and so on. But that turned out to be a really, really good learning experience, and it was the one that kind of brought home to me the possibility. I mean, I had known earlier that it should be possible to do that. In fact, when I owned a sailboat, the name of the boat was Syzygy. I had across the transom of the boat, Syzygy. But I enjoy sailing. That's something I did a while back. I had a 37-foot trimaran.
Oh.
Yeah, that was real ocean-going sailboat. So I've done a lot of things. When people start talking with me about or asking me about things I've done, I haven't traveled the world very much, but I've traveled the U.S. extensively, and I've done lots of things. I've gone canoeing in the Canadian wilderness. I've done spelunking in the caves of Kentucky and southern Indiana. Sailed on the ocean. I was a very adventurous young man. When I was your age, I was out adventuring a lot, and it was fun. I've always been a risk taker. I recommend it to people, because if you don't take risks, you're missing out on a lot of the more interesting parts of life. And a lot of people are risk averse. I don't know if you've noticed. A lot of people will do almost anything to avoid risk. I seek it out sometimes. Less so now that I'm a little older. I'm not physically able to handle some of the vicissitudes of wilderness canoeing and things like that. But I did that a lot when I was young.
Well, still a pretty pretty big leap to move to a different country and...
Tearing myself out of the ground, so to speak, pulling up my roots and moving is something I've done a number of times. I grew up in Ohio, and moved to the Boston area at one point, moved to Hawaii for a while, lived in Oregon for 25 years, moved to Florida, lived in Florida for 10 years, then Arizona from there, and then here. So again, I'm a risk taker, and when I see a possible significant benefit by making that kind of move. Here, the big draw was this community.
Yep.
And Michael's leadership in making things happen here.
Yep.
I hoped when I went to Arizona that would happen in Arizona. And although I got in front of a lot of people and gave a lot of lectures and whatnot, it never really caught on there. Here, we're putting it to work.
The thing I thought about that as well, and I think one of the reasons why it works well here is because, well, if people want to come here, they actually need to want to come here. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you already live here anyway. So it's more of a commit, and when you take that commit, you're more likely to actually participate in the community, apply changes, and so on.
You're right.
And what's also very interesting and fascinating to me is the whole technologies and protocols, the social, the soul bonding, the octologs that you describe. You can do that. You can do that in your own life without needing the permission of anybody, and just implement them and see how far you can get.
Exactly.
And so I think that's a wonderful tool to get rid of hierarchy.
Yes.
Just get people motivated and get them to join an octolog, learn more about it, get more in touch with themselves, and next thing you know is that they don't have a need for a ruler anymore.
Exactly. You're exactly right. I feel my heart just goes, wow, this guy gets it. I really love it.
No, but that was also one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Anarchapulco, because I read the slogan, if you want to change things, you need to create a new model that makes the old one obsolete.
Exactly.
And, yesterday we listened to a talk from Terence McKenna, who was a, do you know him?
Not personally.
He was like a biologist and did a lot of experiments with hallucinogens.
Right.
But he mentioned that primates tend to form dominance hierarchies. And then he explicated that a symbiosis with the mushroom led to consciousness in humans and the emergence of language and so on. And when I heard that, it was really interesting to me, because language gives the opportunity for a negotiation and communication on non-violent basis.
Right.
Which leads to win-win situations. So I feel humans, since they have the capacity for reason, should stand above a dominance hierarchy where it's, well, I'm stronger than you. It's a delegate.
Right. Right. I share the value. I don't use the word should,
mm-hmm.
because should, ought, must, have to are all ways that, these are all phrases that people use that mean someone wants you to. We should, blah, 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 means someone wants us to. But I go back to the ethic, truth, love, awareness, creativity, okay. And if I can increase one of these without limiting or diminishing any of them for anyone, that's a good, valid, ethical response. The thing a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people, when it comes to ethics, I should probably add this, that ethics are not simply a matter of opinion. There is an objective side to ethics. Yes, I can choose as an ethic that I will act on any combination of a value that I esteem and a belief system that purports to support that value. Any. But most of the values and beliefs are such that if you act in accordance with the belief, you don't get more of the thing you value. That's objective. There's an objective criterion for deciding whether an ethic is valid. And when we talk about truth, awareness, love, and creativity, now we have an objectively valid ethic based on that. And that can be tested. You know, you run the experiment. You go, oh, well, that works. Okay. To me, that totally destroys the arguments that ethics are subjective and irrational and arbitrary. Yeah, you can pick them that way, but that's not a good way to pick an ethic. And when people realize that, they go, oh my goodness, I can actually use an objective criterion for deciding how I'm going to make my further future decisions. To me, that's a very exciting piece of the whole thing.
How
how does the phrase like should go into that? Because I kind of missed how the connection was there.
Oh, well, I heard you say should in the sentence that you were using. And I react to that. When I hear should, ought, must, have to, I like to remind people, okay, you're saying that's what you want. You might also care to say that that's an objectively verifiable way of making a decision. Cool. To me, that's more impressive than we should, or I should, or you should. So I substitute when I hear should, ought, must, have to, in my head, oh, someone wants me to, which may or may not be a decent reason for me to follow through on that.
Right.
I use a similar thinking with the word try. I've eliminated it from my vocabulary, mainly because the word try implies failure. If I say I'm going to try to do something, you can count on it, it ain't going to happen. You invite someone to a party. Oh, I'll try to come. You know they're not going to be there. You know they won't. And in fact, hypnotically, if I were to take a book of matches and put them on the table here, and I hypnotize you and convince you that that book of matches weighs 10,000 pounds, boy, the table barely supports it. You can't possibly pick it up. Go ahead and try. You will go, straining to lift it. Oh, can't do it. You will have tried. That's what trying is. It is going through the motions of making the attempt while down deep knowing you're going to fail.
And if you told the person, go ahead and pick it up, what have you ever done that? A difference between saying try or do it?
Sure. If I say, in spite of the fact that it's so heavy, you are strong, you can pick it up. And they will pick it up.
Yeah.
They might do it a little differently than they would if they thought it only weighed a half an ounce, or a quarter of an ounce, or a few grams. But if I tell them, go ahead and try, I can say, go ahead and try to pick it up. You know, and invariably, they fail. That's the meaning of try. In fact, I remember a therapy group that I worked with many years ago that came to the conclusion. They talked about this. They worked it out. They came up with the slogan, trying is lying. And changed. There were 10 people in that group, and it changed their lives profoundly to realize that.
So when you consider taking on a task, instead of saying, I'm going to try to do that, maybe you're on the fence whether it's possible for you or not, I guess. I guess you decide if it is possible or not.
You decide what level of credibility doing it has for you. And you either say, I'm going to do this, or you say, I'll make the attempt. Because somehow making the attempt doesn't have the same baggage that trying does.
It's interesting when you make the distinction in the way you put the words in your head, it's almost like you visualize something else. If I say, I'm going to be at the party, I visualize myself going to the party and knocking at the door, ringing the bell, whatever.
Right.
If I say I'm going to try to be at the party, I imagine myself running through my apartment, trying to get everything ready, and then realizing, oh, it's too much of a hurry, let's just not do it.
Exactly. That's what I meant when I talked about the baggage that goes with the word try.
Mm-hmm.
It's all those unconscious decisions that go into what happens. And trying sets you up not to succeed. So I don't try. And I hear that word in a conversation just jumps out at me. Like, oh, you just said try. What are you trying to do with the word try? How are we doing for time?
We're just about an hour, so I think we can wrap this up and get some lunch.
Okay. Do either of you have a question that you would like to make sure we get answered today?
Yes. Graham was asking at breakfast how a holomat really functions, how the interaction between the different octalogs works, especially if like everybody has the same information. Is it just
Do they all have to reach consensus on important decisions? Like, say you've got three.
There are several
octologues.
There are several tools. In Flourish, in one of the appendices, I think it may be the first appendix, there is a description of what constitutes an ethical contract. I suggest that octologues who want to work together as a holomath form an ethical contract as defined by that chapter. How do they make decisions? There's a lot of choices available, but basically each octologue has to be consistent internally and they have to be in agreement with the other octologue that they're making a contract with. And the details of how that is to emerge become part of the contract. Oh, well, we're going to have such and such discussions. Well, we're going to have group meetings. Well, we're going to meet, there are 16 of us, and we're going to have a meeting in which we break down into a different pairing of groups of eight or groups of four, maybe. And we make decision in groups of four and come back and report to the group at large. There are a lot of choices, but basically you wind up with everyone agrees, or you don't move forward. And you can do that. It's a very doable proposition. And if you have a really hard time making such a decision, maybe you shouldn't be making the decision. You're not ready to.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies within the octologue as well. That until we reach unanimity, we don't have a decision. Up in the air. A lot of people are uncomfortable with leaving something up in the air, but it beats to hell making the wrong, it beats to hell making the wrong decision, the unethical decision. I'd rather not have a decision than make one that leads to unethical consequences. So that's pretty much how the holomath functions. There are other tricks that you can use. For example, you could have at regular intervals, you could have a member of each of two octologues trade places. So this guy goes to this group's meeting and this one goes to this group's meeting. And then you go back to the original group and report on what happened. Or you could have two people switch.
Yep.
And you can have people switching on a regular rotating basis so that everyone in each group gets to participate in another group from time to time. It's up to the groups how they're going to do it. There are descriptions of some of these alternatives in John David Garcia's book, which I recommend, which is called Creative Transformation. And it's no longer in print, but there are almost always used copies for sale all over the place. And it's a much bigger, harder to read book than Flourish, which is one of the reasons I wrote Flourish.
Yeah.
Because, you know, John David, he was far and away the most broadly educated person I ever met, and probably the smartest person I ever met. But he had some gaps in his understanding of the world. He had a character structure too. So, his book, most people, the average reader, would find it difficult reading. It takes above average intelligence reader to get the value out of his book. And I saw that and I thought, wow, I could make this material a lot easier to understand, strip out a lot of unnecessary stuff. He gives, for example, a very detailed explanation of chemical evolution and how that leads to the evolution of life.
Mm-hmm.
He's very knowledgeable about biochemistry. Most people aren't. Most people could care less. I didn't consider that particular explanation as being essential to how do we get along with each other. It is essential to a deeper understanding of how we wind up getting along with each other the way we do or don't. But in order to have a working plan for doing away with hierarchy and changing the world, we don't need that piece of information necessarily. Some might want it, and it's available, but I pared it down to 200 pages. And each of my previous 7 books, I'm covering the same material, but in different ways, trying to find a way of presenting it all that is the shortest, briefest, quickest, comprehensive coverage. So each of my books was on the same subject, but described differently. Mm-hmm. And Flourish is so far the best one, and I'm going to add a new chapter to it. I could put out a new edition. The new chapter will incorporate the soul bonding into the Flourish. So each book will have a chapter about the other.
Nice.
Point at each other, in a sense.
Very cool.
Okay, well, I guess people can look out for that from the links that we're sharing as part of this podcast.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure. I thank you for being interested enough to do this. This is very heartwarming for me.
It's exciting stuff.
All right.